Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll talk about the monstrous health care bill Republicans in the House passed this week with Ryan Cooper from The Week, the magazine The Week. Then we'll be joined by Sarah Posner from the Investigative Fund to discuss Trump's so-called religious freedom order. And finally, last but not least, we'll be joined by David Ferguson from Raw Story to shoot the breeze about various things. But first, a few items you may have missed. I've been out the past couple of weeks on vacation in Mexico, and I have to say that I fully relaxed for the first time since the election, but it wasn't easy. It took a lot of sun and physical exercise and also booze. But apparently I'm not alone. A survey released last month by CareDash.com, and you could certainly take that with a grain of salt, found that almost 2 in 3 Americans say Donald Trump is causing them stress. 6 in 10 report feeling additional stress themselves. The survey found, and I quote, "Americans are dealing with depression, weight gain, suicidal thoughts, trouble sleeping, relationship distress, resentment, anger, and feelings of nervousness because of the November election results, and that this anxiety is manifesting itself in more negative behaviors such as drinking alcohol, smoking, eating unhealthily." It says eating unhealthy, but that's unhealthily, I think is right. "Or arguing with loved ones." Speaking of stress, I found the revelation that French presidential candidate Emmanuel Macron's emails were hacked kind of stressful this week. Not because he will lose to Marine Le Pen, the far-right nationalist with a friendly view of Russia, but because this will keep happening. There's no reason to think that it won't. And I should note that the French media are not breathlessly reporting the leaks like ours did with the DNC hacks. But regular listeners will recall from a segment that we did on Russian hacking, and I should point out that in France there's no debate about who's behind this. Regular listeners will recall that a key objective is to undermine the public's confidence in Western democracies, which this will do. It won't sway the outcome. It will just make us all feel like something's going on. Speaking of Russia, Sputnik News was denied Capitol Hill press credentials. They aren't being singled out. I should point that out. The rules forbid state-run media enterprises getting credentialed, but they are nonetheless crying censorship because, of course, they are. And finally, speaking of Russia and wingnuts, the Washington Post ran a fascinating article last week about growing ties between gun rights advocates and social conservatives here in the U.S. and their Russian counterparts overseas. I'm just going to quote a few sentences. Rosalind Helderman and Tom Hamburger write, and I quote, "On issues including gun rights, terrorism, and same-sex marriage, many leading advocates on the right who grew frustrated with their country's leftward tilt under President Barack Obama have forged ties with well-connected Russians and come to see that country's authoritarian leader, Vladimir Putin, as a potential ally." They go on to write, "The top officials from the National Rifle Association traveled to Moscow to visit a Russian gun manufacturer and meet government officials." About the same time, in December of 2015, evangelist Franklin Graham met privately with Putin for 45 minutes, securing from the Russian president an offer to help with an upcoming conference on the persecution of Christians. The apparent increase in contacts in recent years, as well as the participation of officials from the Russian government and the influential Russian Orthodox Church, leads some analysts to conclude that the Russian government probably promoted the efforts in an attempt to expand Putin's power. So that's happening. And on that note, we'll take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned.
From
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Ryan Cooper. He's a national correspondent for The Week and a good guy to follow on Twitter. Ryan, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I wanted to talk about healthcare. It is hard to describe the atrocities of this latest healthcare bill that passed the House this week. I think that there's so much in it that's bad that it ends up leaving us scattered in terms of conveying what kind of policies are in it. The first time around, there was this very concrete thing. We had a CBO report, said 24 million people would lose their coverage. That's what everybody talked about. Do you think that the fact that the change here, this bill differed in that it allowed states to opt out of Obamacare rules, do you think that that took away from that crushing 24 million people will lose their health care number, or will that come back when the CBO scores it?
Well, that's a tough thing to predict because they did two things. They allowed them to get rid of, not follow the essential health benefits rule or to define their own essential health benefits, which Scott Walker, by the way, in Wisconsin said he would be interested in. And then they made it easier for people to charge people more who have pre-existing conditions. And so what you can unequivocally say is that it would make things worse. You might have a situation where you would, you know, have people just totally scrap this essential health benefits rule so that you could cover, quote unquote, insurance where that doesn't actually cover anything. And so you would be insured, but the deductible will be $15,000 and it wouldn't cover, you know, 3/4 of the things that people needed to cover. And so, you know, you might have a headline number that was somewhat worse or somewhat better in terms of like insurance, but it would be in terms of the volume of healthcare horribleness that's happening, it would be greater than what the previous version, for sure.
The previous iteration of this atrocity. It really is an atrocity. All right, so I wanted to have you on to game out what comes next. And I'm going to set this up. Not everybody is a political junkie, so I'm just going to set this up as quickly as possible. The Senate needs to pass something that via reconciliation, which is supposedly something that affects the budget. It is not supposed to deal with non-budgetary issues, and it is not subject to the filibuster. The problem in the House that they had was that you had some moderates who were worried about their re-elections, or if you're more generous, they were worried about the impact of the law. And you had this conservative group, the Freedom Caucus, for whom the law was not cruel enough. Now they have to get something through the Senate and come back to conference and hopefully not for America and our healthcare, hammer something out that can be acceptable to both sides. So as far as the Senate, what are you hearing in terms of the process over on that side?
Well, the last sort of scuttlebutt that I heard was that they're not even going to vote on the House bill. They're going to build their own thing sort of from scratch. And I believe this still means, though, that we are going to get a CBO score on the House bill next week, because in order to determine whether or not it fits reconciliation rules, you have to know what the impact will be on the budget deficit. And so in order for the Senate to avoid the filibuster, they have to go through the CBO first.
But they're starting with their own bill. They're going to write their own bill, right?
Right. And you would think, I mean, people in the Senate, you know, the real whack jobs are in the House. People, you know, Senate Republicans are pretty conservative, but, you know, Susan Collins is in there. You can only lose 3 votes. And so probably it will be substantially more moderate than whatever the House is putting through. But I think, you know, I think they could probably pass something. It would be maybe halfway between Obamacare as it exists now and the thing that the House passed. And then after that, and I think that the you know, it probably could die in the Senate. You know, people could just even if it's halfway between, 12 million as opposed to 24 million people losing their insurance, that's still pretty bad.
Yes.
And especially all the harms would be concentrated in the red states too, because that's where, poorest people live. You could easily see it tripping up there. But I think the biggest hurdle for Republicans in general will be hashing out conference differences, because the Freedom Caucus is going to, they always say, my way or the highway, we're going to have the most brutal thing that you could imagine. And, it just takes a couple of Senate Republicans to stop that from happening. But, I definitely also wouldn't rule it out at all. This is a live hand grenade, and you never underestimate the depravity of the Republican Party.
It's a bad idea. It is a bad idea. It's analytically flawed to underestimate it. But let me ask you this on the question of depravity. The way it works with reconciliation is that they go to the Senate parliamentarian and they say, here's a provision. Does this pass muster according to the Byrd rule? But we don't have to get into that. Again, these things have to be primarily impacting the deficit or the budget. And they can't have a purpose that isn't related to the budget. So if you think about something like allowing states to opt out of an essential benefits package, that is unlikely to pass muster. Now, the majority party could overrule the parliamentarian, which means that they can basically stick anything that they want into a reconciliation bill if they're willing to go there. We know that they don't have an inherent respect for the norms of these institutions, for the rules. But in the same way as Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, is hesitant to blow up the filibuster for legislation, he knows that there is a very good likelihood that Republicans will have more than 40 seats and less than 50 seats after 2020, perhaps, and is hesitant to create a precedent that the Democrats, if when they come back into power, might exploit. Do you think that they would overrule the Senate parliamentarian? How do you think that those competing impulses, get anything done, ram it through, or worry about when the tables are turned, how do you think that that'll play out?
I think you're correct to say that McConnell is going to be the hinge point, because you're correct. It was funny to see Democrats in 2009, regarding this thing as sacrosanct, when, the fact of the matter is the Senate writes its own rules. And if you don't, if you don't have a parliamentarian who doesn't give you the answer you want, you could just replace him, and put in your own guy. I think there'll be two things that will determine the swing votes among Senate Republicans will come down. And that will be the reaction they get from their home states, because you could definitely see people just getting an earful from their constituents. And secondly, the way that McConnell is thinking about, I would say, not just his future position and how Republicans might exploit things, but also his own personal power right now. Because if you get rid of the filibuster completely, then that really reduces his power in terms of being able to sort of control being the sticking point between House, stuff coming out of the House and, going to the president. Because, if there's no more filibuster, then the pressure on him increases a lot to, do whatever crazy stuff the House is coming up with. Whereas he right now can blame it on Democrats, filibustering, whatever it is. So, it's pretty tough to hazard a prediction there. I would guess that they will come up with something that is, they probably won't fire the parliamentarian. They'll come up with something that will follow the strictures of the, bend it and almost to the breaking point, but not quite. And then, after that, they'll go into conference. But I thought, when Trump was first elected, I thought that McConnell would just get rid of the filibuster completely. But it's making more sense to me now, as to why he didn't do that. It's the Republican caucus is more divided than it seemed at first.
Right.
And that, you know, especially somebody like McConnell is not, you know, he's a lot more concerned with winning elections than he is with implementing Paul Ryan's sort of Ayn Rand agenda.
And certainly more than building a border wall or a deportation force. I always thought that he would maintain the filibuster in order to blame Democrats when he goes back to his base, right? You have this.
Yeah.
The Trumpers are, as you know, as a journalist in this era, they're mean. They're really mean. And, you know, there's a lot of anger out there. And I think that he wanted to have a layer of insulation where he could say, hey, it's the Democrats. They have they filibustered it. I need 60 votes. I couldn't get 60 votes. And that would allow him to temper the Trump agenda and kind of avoid the more extreme policy proposals that Trump might tweet out. And then everybody has to, you know, chase down for the next few months. Do you have a sense of whether they're going to slow walk this? Because Mitch McConnell, a little while ago, he said, and this was before the debacle in the House, he said, we can draft this in a few weeks and we're going to have a vote on this in a few weeks. Now he's saying we want to temper expectations. It's going to be a slow and deliberative process. What do you think is going on with the timing?
I think that McConnell, you know, is... I remember Joe Weisenthal had an interesting tweet today, and he was like, I know a lot of conservatives follow me and we interact. Can somebody give me a substantive defense of this bill? And nobody could do it.
Yes. He said, can anybody tell me how this is not a redistribution of wealth?
Yeah.
Upward redistribution of wealth.
Because it very obviously is.
Yes.
And there is a massive enthusiasm gap, or maybe you could say like an enraged hatred gap between, you know, Democrats, liberals on and the, you know, base for the Democrats and the whole Republican Party. You know, nobody wants this thing. And you know, he's got to be thinking in his mind, you know, Democrats did this thing, Obamacare, which, you know, it wasn't that great in the public mind. You know, it was pretty unpopular until now when they're trying to take it away, of course. But you look at the polling numbers for the Trump Care or whatever, AHCA, and it's way worse, way, way worse than Obamacare ever was. And I think that, you know, once people really get wind of what's in this thing, it's going to be even more unpopular because, it's almost impossible to get your head around how horrible this is. You know, this is like, I think you could say in terms of domestic health care policy legislation, like maybe like top two worst things has ever been passed.
Yes, it really is. It really is. Go ahead.
There'll be people who died. You know, Democrats will be making. Remember that ad from Yul Brynner when he died, and he had that ad that ran after he was dead. It's like, I'm Yul Brynner, and I'm dead now because I smoke cigarettes. There'll be Democrats doing ads like that. Like, you know, I'm Jeff Smith, and I'm dead because Republicans killed me. You know, like that. There'll be thousands of people like this.
Yes.
And, you know, I think Mitch McConnell's probably looking at that being like, oh, dear, you know, this could be like, you know, a once in a generation electoral tidal wave. The Democrats are not just, they're going to come back and they're not just going to replace Obamacare. It'll be single payer, you know, because like we tried to compromise and give you half a loaf and look at how you treated us. Now it's just going to, we're just going to stamp the entire insurance industry into the dirt.
From your lips to God's ears. I think that Mitch McConnell wants nothing to do with this. It seems like it's a hot potato. Republicans need to pass something. They promised for 8 years. They said that Obamacare was basically almost as bad as a planet killing meteor. And then, they all want to go back to their base, their home districts, if their home districts are red districts, and say, I voted it to repeal. And they don't actually want to repeal because, of course, the consequences are disastrous. They don't want to own that. And when you control all branches of government, you do own that. Let me ask you this, and it's a call for speculation. I know reporters hate that. but what do you think the odds are? Give me odds on something coming out of the conference. And let me, I'm actually going to build this question up just a little bit more. There were people in the House who voted for this monstrosity because there was a wink and a nudge, and they said, don't worry, the Senate won't let this pass. So let's say that the Senate passes something less awful, but still really, really bad. And they go to conference, and the conference report will only kick 12 million people, as you said, off of their health care. At that point, there's going to be a massive pressure from the base to get it done because they've gotten so close to the finish line. And then this massive counter pressure from everybody who is not part of the base because it's awful and it polls terribly and people hate it. What do you think the chances are that they get something through at the end?
My wild guess, if they get to a conference committee, is there's a 37.2% chance that they'll pass something.
Excellent. 37. I'm going to quote you on that. You know that, right?
To be Nate Silverish about it, yeah, it's precisely. And so I can't be wrong, you know, because yeah, either way, it confirms my, you know, that was, right. It's definitionally correct.
It's the 538 check, right?
Yeah. I would think, you know, that there'll be a lot of people, you know, facing an election in 2018 that would just be like, ooh, you know, and you can only lose a couple in the Senate. And you can only, I mean, what did it pass in the House by one vote?
By one vote. So if you lose one moderate because it's too extreme or one Freedom Caucus member because it's not extreme enough, it doesn't pass.
Yeah. And there were, you know, what did they say? 35, you know, swingish districts where something like that, where House Republicans voted for that thing. And, you know, that is you're taking your political life in your hands, you know, yeah. A lot of those districts is like 20 of them. Hillary Clinton actually won them.
It was 24 that Hillary won. And then another 12 in which Donald Trump did not win a majority. So he had a plurality. Folks, what this all means, and I think that those of us who are part of the so-called resistance, those of you out there who are protesting, calling your legislators, doing whatever you're doing, the Senate is going to be watching the reaction to the House. They're going to be watching that very carefully. Progressive groups raised $4 million yesterday, something like that. We're recording this on Friday. So this is the day after it passed. And it's really crucial to make sure that the Senate hears you loud and clear and understands that you are going to remember this vote, and you're going to remember who took your health care away if they indeed do so. Ryan Cooper, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
What's your Twitter handle again?
Ryan L. Cooper.
Folks, follow Ryan on Twitter and check out his stuff at The Week. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
Woo, you sure got to climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Hey, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, you're right, there ought to be a law. And he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol. Federal Hill. Well, now I'm stuck in committee, and I'll sit here and wait while a few key congressmen discuss and debate whether they should let me be a law. How I hope and pray that they will, but today I am still just a bill.
Listen to those congressmen arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee. Oh, but it looks like I'm gonna live. Now I go to the House of Representatives and they vote on me.
If they vote yes, what happens?
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill. And if they vote for me on Capitol Hill, well, then I'm off to the White House, where I'll wait in a line with a lot of other bills for the president to sign. And if he signs me, then I'll be a law. How I hope and pray that he will, but today I am still just a bill.
You mean even if the whole says you should be a law, the president can still say no?
Yes, that's called a veto. If the president vetoes me, I have to go back to Congress and they vote on me again, and by that time you're so old.
By that time, it's very unlikely that you become a law. It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No,
but how I hope and pray that I will, but today I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill, now you're a law.
Oh, yes!
Welcome back to the show. Almost 3 months ago to the day, we had Sarah Posner, who is one of the best journalists on the politics and religion beat, on the show to talk about a leaked draft of an executive order on, quote, religious freedom that Trump was considering signing. That was then. She told us what an abomination it was, pardon the quasi pun. So when Trump signed an order this week that was billed as giving religious organizations more freedom to participate in electoral politics and private companies a right to discriminate, I figured we should try to get Sarah back on the show to follow up. And here she is, Sarah Posner. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you for taking the time. Sarah, I should add, is a journalist with the Investigative Fund. Sarah, the ACLU is all set to sue, but after reviewing the executive order, they decided it was a big nothing burger. They said it doesn't change existing policy and they wouldn't bother taking him to court. But the Freedom From Religion Foundation is going ahead with their lawsuit. And I noticed that they talk not only about the text of the order, but Trump's statements about it, which is similar to what happened with the Muslim ban. And I'll just quote from them. They say Trump told churches that with his new order, they would not lose their tax exemption for violating the rule and could say whatever they wanted. And they quote him directly. Trump said, "This financial threat against the faith community is over. You're now in a position where you can say what you want to say." Sarah, what's going on here?
What's going on here is that Trump doesn't really understand what the law is and how the law has been enforced. I know this is shocking news, but
yes,
let me explain. So there's a part of the Internal Revenue Code called the Johnson Amendment that basically says to all tax-exempt organizations, not just religious ones, that you cannot use your tax-exempt dollars to endorse political candidates. If you do that, you risk losing your tax-exempt status. It doesn't tell you that you can't talk about any political issue under the sun. It just says you cannot use tax-exempt dollars to endorse candidates. Now, this law, this part of the Internal Revenue Code, has long been under fire by the religious right. They have created this phony narrative that it suppresses their free speech rights and it suppresses the religious freedom of pastors who want to speak about political issues. But that's just a complete red herring, because pastors can speak about political issues with no risk to their tax-exempt status.
Right.
So Trump has basically bought in to this narrative by the religious right and is parroting their claims. In addition to the law being extremely narrow, as I just described, it has not really been enforced by the IRS. There hasn't been a revocation of a tax-exempt status in years, I think since, like, the Clinton era, over a candidate endorsement. It also applies to candidate non-endorsements, but, you know, so let's just get that on the table too.
Right.
You know, saying don't vote for Bill Clinton.
Don't vote for this person.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right.
So, and the kind of hilarious, ironic, ridiculous thing about this is that many of the people who were there for Trump's signing ceremony in the Rose Garden and there at the White House the night before for a dinner that he had for them were pastors who had endorsed Trump with no consequences to their tax exempt status.
So, but the executive order that he signed, even though he says that it would kill the Johnson Amendment, it doesn't actually do that.
No, because Congress would have to repeal the Johnson Amendment. And so far, even though bills have been introduced to do that, there doesn't appear to be a lot of will to do that, because I think even Republican members of Congress know, for one thing, it's unpopular even among white evangelicals for pastors to endorse political candidates.
Right.
And secondly, you would turn all nonprofits, not just religious nonprofits and churches and synagogues and mosques, into basically political machinery, but you would turn even secular nonprofits into that. And I think that a lot of Republicans realize that and realize that they probably don't want to go down that road.
Well, let me ask you this. We're limited for time today. Let me ask you, what is not in this executive order that was in the draft that you wrote about back in late January, I think it was, or early February? We had you on the show February 4th.
Right. So basically the original draft was a laundry list of things, a laundry list of religious exemptions for basically anyone, any religious person in any walk of life, whether they work at a church or a religious organization or work for a for-profit company. It would exempt them from having to provide catering or photography or a government clerk providing a marriage license, or, you know, like the whole laundry list of religious right fears that LGBT rights will force them to participate in same-sex weddings. But it was so, so broad. Basically, anybody could deny service to anyone whose sexual mores they disagreed with, not just LGBT people.
It was just this.
That would be bad enough.
Broad license to discriminate based on your personal beliefs, right? So that,
right, exactly.
That got out of there. And now you wrote, though, at The Nation this week about another something that remains in this order that gives Jeff Sessions, who we don't want to give too much authority to, God forbid, it basically provides a loophole that he might exploit. Tell us a little bit about that.
So while the original draft had this laundry list of a license to discriminate, that was what caused the huge outcry against the draft. And also, I mean, I think that any sensible legal expert, even in the Trump administration, would look at that and see that it would almost instantly be challenged in court and that it was in all likelihood unconstitutional. So all of that was stripped out in favor of this very sort of vague paragraph that directed Jeff Sessions to interpret laws pertaining to religious freedom for the agencies. Now, to me, this opens a very wide door, because under the Bush administration, Justice Department lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel interpreted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to permit federal contractors to discriminate in hiring based on their religious preferences. And so basically what a religious taxpayer-funded religious organization can do is they can go to the Justice Department and say, hey, we'd like an exemption from existing laws on non-discrimination in employment. Thank you very much. Give us this little certificate that enables us to do that. So church-state separation advocates have worried for a long time that this memo, it's called the OLC memo or the World Vision memo, could be expanded into like other areas beyond employment to say, oh, hey, like I provide drug addiction services under a contract with the Department of Health and Human Services, and I really don't want to serve transgender people, so can I get exemption from having to do that? So this is something that has worried advocates for many years. So this provision in there, to me, this provision that sort of gives Jeff Sessions open season on interpreting RFRA for federal agencies who give a lot of these grants and contracts to religiously affiliated social service providers is very troubling. And I think a lot of people have overlooked it because I think it's just an incredibly big open door for things that are very hard to track and trace because it would be written into a federal contract that isn't necessarily made public without a FOIA request. You would have to know which taxpayer-funded entities were asking for it and how it, you know, so it could get very complicated. And given the lack of transparency in the Trump administration, it could be prove very difficult to keep track of this.
This is something
or even know about it.
Yeah, this is something to keep an eye on. I'm not even going to ask you whether evangelicals feel like they got rolled with the difference between how Trump talks about the order and the actual effects of it. So far, at least, we know that Trump supporters are pretty much immune to news of his various flip-flops and betrayals. But I would say that his ability to reverse course on other issues without any particular harm with his base has emboldened this regime to screw over the evangelical community like everybody else. Anyway, Sarah Posner, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for joining us this week and catching us up on the latest.
Happy to do it, Joshua. Thank you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with David Ferguson from Raw Story.
Some men desire a princess and others lust for a temptress. Well, I don't need one of those, 'cause my love is you. My love is you. Some men replace their mamas and some want a young boy out of nowhere. I got no use for those. Sometimes, dear, you tell me I'm an asshole. Sometimes you're an asshole, too. Even though we're filled with imperfections, I don't think any less of you.
Back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by David Ferguson. David is a senior editor at Raw Story. David, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I should state that the views I express while I'm here are not the views of Raw Story. They are my views, and I'm not appearing here as a representative of Raw Story. I'm purely here.
Can you say that much faster?
I'm purely here in my capacity as a surrogate of the Trump campaign.
Speaking of the Trump campaign, he said that he would be able to shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't blink. But that's not necessarily true, huh? There has been a little bit of maybe not buyer's remorse, but some frustration among Trumpers over the budget that was passed that will continue funding the government through the end of September, I believe it is. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, as a fish that lives in this aquarium, I'm very grateful that the pump will continue to work through September. the buyer's remorse, I don't think it's ever going to fully set in because we keep seeing over and over, if he continues to harp on people's sense of resentment, he will fire them back up again and they will forgive any number of sins, include up to and including like sexual assault. So, yeah, maybe he could shoot somebody. in the middle of Fifth Avenue if the next day he decided to lay into Rosie O'Donnell or, right. you know.
Right, right. Well, you know, it would be great if some intrepid reporter would go somewhere, Trump country, and interview some of his supporters and see if they're still in love with him, because we haven't seen that story at all.
No, not ever.
So did the Democrats, I mean, how badly did they play him with the budget?
Well, is this a matter of the Democrats doing the right thing or just not making any, you know, not stepping on their own genitalia, as it were?
I think not
doing anything wrong is not the same as doing the right thing. I think they just, I mean, go ahead, give me your, go ahead, please.
So this is my thought. This guy is thin-skinned. He's egomaniacal, and he was obsessed with this arbitrary idea of 100 days. He had to have accomplishments in 100 days. I think that they took advantage of, well, two things. They took advantage of the fact that he would sign off on something that didn't have any of his priorities. And I guess we should make that clear to listeners who don't pay attention to budget things, that they passed this budget. It's got no funding for the wall. It's got no deportation funding for a deportation force. It's the status quo from the last Obama budget, basically, with a little bit of extra money for military spending. So I think that they said, okay, this guy is desperate to be seen as effective within the first 100 days. He's not going to let them shut the government down, and they took advantage of that. And then the other thing they took advantage of is that you have this the Freedom Caucus is what they call themselves. Ryan Lizza called them the Suicide Caucus. And there's these red state legislators in very safe districts, and they don't believe in government. So they're just not going to sign on to anything. So they knew that he needs Democratic votes to pass this thing. And I think that they played it pretty well, actually.
Yeah, well, so we got funding for Planned Parenthood. We got no funding for the wall, continued Obamacare subsidies. I mean, it's not a terrible, terrible, heinous, hideous, awful budget. but I watched the ineptitude of the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill, and I can't give them credit for getting anything. I mean, you know, did you win anything by not falling into the river full of piranha? Sure.
Well, look, I mean, the context of this is that they have control of nothing, right? So when they are able to exercise some influence and power, I think I give them some credit for that. So did you catch Sean Spicer fighting with, I think it was a reporter from Breitbart, about whether a fence is a wall?
Well, it's like Seth Meyers said last night, they're openly effing with him now. You know, they're just like, it's a wall. It's been, oh, it's, let's go. No, show us your wall. Go on, Spicer. Let's see what you got, you know? And he's like, you know, the dog ate my homework. My mother said I needed to, you know, it's just, oh, poor Sean Spicer.
Oh, I don't know. Poor Sean Spicer. He is. So I coined this term, and I was hoping that it would take off in the era of Trump. It is hilarifying. It's hilarious and terrifying. It's terrifying to think that this guy is tasked with communicating things to the public, and yet it's hilarious every time he tries.
Yeah, it seems that his mouth regularly falls asleep. Like, you know, it becomes completely and utterly disconnected from the rest of his body and just says things like, well, you know, Hitler didn't use chemical weapons.
And I like how reporters at the end of that, they came on and they said, well, you know what? He has made a coherent statement. They gave him credit for that, as if that's not his job.
My favorite thing about that whole moment, though, is the watching April Ryan. You know, there's a camera shot of the audience, and you know, when he's making that statement, and April Ryan's head just sort of pops up for a second. Her BS meter just kind of went ding, and she like looks around like, am I hearing this? Is this real?
It was a great moment in
April
GIFs.
Ryan is our collective unconscious, I think, in the age of Trump.
I believe you're right about that. I come back to this 100 days thing. So I've been watching, and I try not to do this, but it's on at the gym. I've been watching Fox, and Fox has been playing up this 100 days like it is a substantial benchmark, when it's always been this idea that, you know, you get this 100 days of honeymoon period. There was never going to be a honeymoon period between Donald Trump and certainly not Democrats, but even his own party, seems to me that it's a frenemy kind of thing, right? I mean, that there's a lot of Republicans in Congress who don't agree with him on key issues like trade, and they are happy to exercise power, but I mean, he's not one of them.
And this is where I get really cynical and angry, because you would think that these people who claim the mantle solely of America's patriots would be a little more alarmed about what's going on, and a little less just like, well, we're going to let him do his thing and make a lot of noise while we quietly privatize the rainwater and the air in people's lungs.
Right.
It's dispiriting to think that people can watch this kind of, because it's not governing at this point. When you have so many agencies unstaffed and so much wild dysfunction and hostilities mounting with North Korea, at this point, it's vandalism of our system of government. And you would think that somebody in the Republican Party would be like, maybe we should take a step back from this. But they seem to be, as long as they're allowed to take away people's health care and like starve old people and put them out in the street, they're fine. They get their sadistic jollies, and whatever the president wants to do is just fine by them.
Yeah, I mean, partisanship is intensely tribal. It's inherently tribal. And, you know, I've been thinking since the advent of Trump, what kind of Democratic candidate would get me to bail? And I think that it wouldn't be somebody who is just goofy. I obviously wouldn't support somebody like Trump, who had this, you know, the kind of toxic mix of bigotry and stupidity. But
somebody who was goofy from the Democratic Party would never make it through the forest of knives that would come down on them, or the rain of swords from the Fox News. You can't. There is an unfair standard. There's a much lower bar for Republican candidates in this country.
Yeah.
Obviously. Right. Look who's the president now. And you look at the hoops that Clinton had to jump through during the election, as opposed to Trump, who crashed and burned on every single debate. And it's very clear to me that it's going to have to be a very tricky, very clever, very like made of steel Democratic candidate that's going to make it to the top. So, I mean, the people who we would normally find objectionable, the people who I could see that would drive us out of the Democratic Party, are kind of relegated to the fringes because we have such a rigorous standard for Democratic politicians.
Right. And there is no equivalent to Trump in the Democratic side. I mean, who would that be?
Kanye West? you know, Michael Moore wants The Rock to run.
Michael Moore would be the equivalent of Donald Trump, maybe. But
there's
Michael
a theme
smart
here
guy.
Because Michael Moore ran a plant for a state legislature in Germany. I mean, Germany, in New Jersey. Or didn't he? No, it was in Michigan.
I mean, he's a smart guy. He understands public policy. He's he's a showman, but like Trump. But he has a fundamental understanding. You know that he's at least watched Schoolhouse Rock.
Right.
I mean, Donald Trump, he celebrated passing an awful health care bill through one chamber of Congress. And
With a Rose Garden ceremony.
I'm not exactly sure that he knows that it has to go through the Senate also.
Most of his followers don't. I mean, if you looked at Twitter yesterday, they were all rejoicing that Obamacare is no more. It's gone. It's done. And some of them were kind of quietly tapping them on the shoulder and explaining that there are two houses of Congress. But
I lamented that on Twitter. I actually think that the media has some responsibility for that, because they have been reporting it as a win. And I'm talking about not just the kind of wingnut media, but the mainstream media as well. There's been a lot of talk about Trump getting a big win. And,
which is so tragic, because it's like we're celebrating someone who's coming back from a tragic cranial accident's ability to get a fork full of peas into their mouth without putting out one of their eyes.
Yeah, I mean,
and the bar is so low.
Be set lower. Yes, the bar cannot be set lower.
It's ridiculous. I mean, you look at the people who are on television who are representing the Democratic Party right now. Adam Schiff, you know, who's like basically an algebra teacher. And these very sober sort of like studio. Trying to think of some other good examples. But and then we turn on Fox News and we get the clown show. We get Steve King with his like hollow blue eyes where like you can just look at those eyes and see the tumbleweeds blowing through. It's bad.
I mean, Jeffrey Lord is on CNN.
Oh, gosh. He hasn't actually held a job in any administration, though, since 1989, has he?
Didn't he come from the
Reagan
the
administration?
Spectator?
I think that they're like DeLoreans on the road the last time he actually had a job. that wasn't part of the sinecure of Republican think tanks and various lobbying organizations that they filter through.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you wrote this week about a website for people. This is kind of weird. The thing that people can do if Trump care actually kills them.
Yes. If Trump care kills you, the website, send me to the GOP, I think. I'll have to look that address up.
It's mailmetothegop.com.
We'll send your ashes to the Republican member of Congress of your choice if they're being denied care or not being able to get your medications or for some reason you die as a result of the American Health Care Act. But the only stipulation for me that bothers me about that is that it's not like the glitter bombs that they don't open it and explodes all over their office.
It'll also never get through the congressional mailroom, which filters out, I think, foreign substances, that powdery foreign substances. I don't think they actually get to your rep. But it's a great idea. So if you do die and you want to know what to do with your ashes, you can have them sent to a Republican of your choice. The other big news that I missed, and I've been out for a few weeks. I was in Mexico. Sebastian Gorka, the actual, is he the actual Nazi in this regime?
There's some controversy around that, whether or not he actually belongs to that party in Hungary, although he wore their medal and he used a little V in his name like they do, like this lifelong members of the party, when they sign their name, they have a little V in there. So it looks like their first name is suing their last name. but yeah, they had to rehome him.
So what happened? What brought him down?
Well, I just, you know, it, with these exotic pets, it's just like that. The Austro-Hungarian neo-fascist hound is not an indoor animal.
I mean, the funny thing is that the national security community, for what it's worth, they've been saying that he's just a complete goofball and that he got his degree in a Cracker Jack's box, I believe.
Basically, yeah, the bottom of a Cracker Jack box. Not worth the paper it's printed on. And yet he's so insistent to everyone that he must be called Dr. Gorka.
It's remarkable. I mean, that is a
I'm trying to figure out. It's my personal quest to figure out who has milked the fact that Americans think every British accent sounds intelligent more. Him, Milo Yiannopoulos, or Andrew Sullivan. Did you see where that Trump fan the other day told J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author, that if she didn't like it, she should move to Canada or Mexico. She's like, I think I'll stick with Scotland.
We're recording this, of course, on Friday, Cinco de Mayo, which was a holiday begun in California, promoted by American beer companies. And it always brings out the bigots.
Mike Pence is celebrating. He's leading the Cinco de Mayo ceremony or celebration at the White House tonight.
So I guess it's
going to be Cinco de Mayonnaise, I think.
Cinco de Mayo. Mike Pence is the whitest human being on the entire planet.
He's so Handmaid's Tale. He frightens me. He's the one that can't be trusted to go anywhere with any woman who's not his wife without a chaperone.
Yes. Because weird. And remember when Marcos Melitzas wrote that book, American Taliban, and everybody lost their minds because it was so unfair to compare the American religious right to the Taliban. And here's Mike Pence saying, well, I can't be alone with a woman who isn't my wife. And the follow up question.
And the other thing is, like, why? Is he going to get contaminated somehow? Is her like.
No, it's because he can't control his loins.
Subtle dark woman magic will invade him somehow. And he will, like.
They're wily like that. They're beguiling. So, he could not control his lust, I guess. I guess that's what it is. But the follow up that must have been asked and was not asked, would it be okay if she was in a burqa?
That is a good question.
That's a good question. Somebody should ask that. I should be a White House correspondent for reasons like this. All right, final thing before I let you go. You wrote this week about this retired CIA expert talking about how the far right is being played by Russia.
The Russians.
Yeah, what about that?
That is a strange and baffling. You know, okay, so here's the thing. We know that Russians love a useful idiot. They love to have people carrying out their agenda that have no idea they're carrying out the agenda. And these people who can't get any more ideological traction, or at least not enough to live the lifestyles that they like, like the National Organization for Marriage, Brian Brown, you know, they've kind of lost the battle here. So they're getting support from people in Russia and huge donations from wealthy Russians that are friends of Putin's. And they seem to think it's just because these people are their fellow travelers. Ideologically, they're virulently anti-gay. They're very like pro, quote unquote, traditional marriage. But the CIA expert's like, no, Russians don't do that. They don't just make friends with you because you share certain ideology. Those people are being used as pawns in something much bigger that we don't understand yet. In the way that we don't understand, we're still piecing together how they nuked us with the information war during the 2016 election.
Right.
We're just kind of running around behind them. And this is the problem with having a chief executive who has no imagination, is that there's no effort right now to say, well, the Russians, Comey said at the hearing the other day, the Russians are still actively trying to influence American politics. But we have an administration now that is either completely naive when it comes to the Russians, completely in bed with the Russians, or just so oblivious that they're just getting played like chess pieces by the Russians, or just it's frightening.
It's not just on the right either. David Ferguson, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, David, nothing he said today represents the views of the editorial perspective of the Raw Story, blah, blah, blah. But you can read him at rawstory.com. I would also like to thank Ryan Cooper and Sarah Posner. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud, wherever else you find the show. I'd also like to thank the good people at Hullabaloo, Digby's Hullabaloo, Crooks and Liars, and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. And, of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Maybe I didn't hold you all those lonely, lonely times. And I guess I never told you.